couple months ago in one of our Oasis leader training classes, we got off on a tangent talking about some of the things that people say against gay and transgender people. As I shared various recommended responses, the group said to me, "You really need to present this in a sermon sometime." As we are ready to launch round two of Would Jesus Discriminate today, this seems as good a time as any to present those ideas. Because if you are associated with this church, it is rather inevitable that sometime in the next few weeks, somebody is going to ask you, some family member, friend, neighbor, co-worker, some provocateur, somebody is going to ask you to defend your church's position on these issues. And we should welcome that. The Bible says in 1 Peter 3:15, always be ready to give an answer to anyone who demands from you a reason for the hope that is in you. So today, let's get ready to answer, beginning with prayer. God, there are so many people in this world that need hope, especially gay or transgender people who have been pushed away from so many churches. God, there are so many good-hearted, straight people whose souls are burdened down with the heavy weight of cultural prejudice. Today, grow our ability to share answers that will help set them free. In Jesus' name. Amen. Of course, there are a million different directions that today's sermon could take. We could talk about the affirming passages that are found in the Bible, or we could talk about some of those passages that people commonly try to use against gay and transgender people. But in prior sermons, I've already covered all of that territory, and all of that content has now been loaded on to the customized website that we've developed for round two of this campaign. So if you have questions about those Bible passages, or if you just want to bone up in anticipation of discussions you might have with friends, go today on to wouldjesusdiscriminate.com and read until your heart is content. Today, though, instead of rehashing information I have shared in prior sermons, the more obvious stuff, I want to talk about some material that is less obvious but equally critical. In fact, maybe even more critical in the final analysis. Imagine yourself sitting in a rocking chair on the front porch having a conversation with your Aunt Granny. That name, Aunt Granny, I have encountered along with David in our travels to Dollywood in Tennessee. It's kind of a colorful name, don't you think? You can sort of picture what Aunt Granny would be like. I wish I had an Aunt Granny in my family. So picture yourself, you're sitting in the rocking chair, you're having a little chat with Aunt Granny when out of the blue, she says to you, "Have you seen all those crazy signs around town saying that God approves of gay people?" "Yes, Aunt Granny," you say, "I've seen those signs." "Well," she says, "aren't they the most outrageous thing you've ever seen?" "Well, actually, Aunt Granny, I go to that church." After her dentures drop out on the porch floor, and she picks them up and puts them back in, she leans forward and says, "Why do you go to that church?" "Because it's a great church." "Yeah," she says, "but aren't there lots of, you know, fruits that go to that church?" "Aunt Granny," you say, "if God created certain people that way, why should we care about that?" "Well," she says, "just because somebody is born that way doesn't mean that it's right. Pedophiles say they were born that way, and that doesn't make them right. Studies show that addictions often have a genetic basis, and that doesn't make addiction right. Besides," Aunt Granny says, "from the beginning of time, it's been one man and one woman. And look how well that's worked." "Aunt Granny," you say, "you can't stand Uncle Bert. Never mind, she says. A bad relationship that's right is better than a good relationship that's wrong. What? Well, all I know, she says, is that the Bible says that in the last days there will be false prophets who rise up and deceive people. How do you know that your pastor is not a false prophet? How can you be so sure you're right? Now, say what you will about Aunt Granny, she's a pretty darn good debater. In one short conversation, she has managed to raise three of the key arguments that people often make against gay and transgender people. Let's go back through each of those three arguments one by one, beginning with her point about false prophets. The Bible warns us. In 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 1, it says, false prophets arose among the people in olden times, just as there will be false teachers among you who will secretly bring in destructive opinions. Jesus repeats essentially the same thing in our gospel reading today, Matthew 7, verse number 15. He says, beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves. It's kind of scary, isn't it, to think that in the Christian movement there always have been and there always will be certain false prophets who are trying to persuade us to embrace destructive opinions. It's kind of spooky to look at a spiritual leader and find yourself wondering, could he, could she be a false prophet? How do we tell the difference between prophets that are true and prophets that are false? Jesus tells us in Matthew 7:16, the very next verse, there he articulates a principle that is absolutely brilliant and absolutely foundational, so much so that it is the response not only to Aunt Granny's false prophet charge, but each of her other charges as well. Look at what Jesus says in Matthew 7:16. You shall know them, referring to false prophets, you shall know them by their fruits. Are grapes gathered from thorns or figs from thistles? Of course not. Grapes grow on grapevines, not on thorn bushes. And figs, delicious figs, grow on fig trees, not on trees that have thistles and thorns. In the same way, Jesus says, every good tree bears good fruit, but every bad tree bears bad fruit. And there you have it. Understand what Jesus is saying in this verse, and you will be able to spot a false prophet every time. How? By doing a simple fruits analysis. And that is something that in this congregation we ought to be pretty darn good at, because there are so many fruits here, right? Actually, when Jesus uses that term, he's not using it in that slang sense. By the way, do you remember how in grade school that used to be the term of choice to describe gay people, for at least when I grew up in grade school, down at Acton grade school? And remember how boys' shirts used to have those little hooks, those little loops in the back that everybody called fruit loops? Yeah, those were the days, right? And of course, you would always detach your fruit loop from the back of your shirt so that nobody would think that you were a fruit. And if you forgot, of course, a good friend would come up behind you and rip it off so that nobody would think that you were a fruit. I had any number of Fruit Loops ripped off my shirt during grade school. Of course, never took, but many of my friends tried very hard. By the way, have you heard that Bible scholars have discovered incontrovertible evidence that Adam, the first human, was gay? How else do you explain that even as he was standing next to an incredibly beautiful woman, he was tempted by a fruit? But I digress. When Jesus bids us to do a fruits analysis, he's not using it in that slang sense, But rather, he's saying, when you find yourself wondering whether a Christian minister is authentic, examine the fruits of the ministry that that minister is leading. Ah, you say, now I'm starting to get it. So if I want to know if a spiritual leader is the real deal or not, I should look around, I should examine that person's ministry, see if it's growing and prospering. See if it's the kind of ministry that is producing miracles of healing and tremendous sermons. You know, the kinds of things that draw huge crowds, right? Wrong. Because just a few verses later in Matthew 7:21, Jesus tells us that there will be many spiritual leaders who have preached incredible sermons, who have worked miracles of healing, who have cast out demons in the name of Jesus, who nevertheless on the day of great judgment will be turned away because they never had an authentic relationship with Jesus Christ. So forget the externalities. That's not the kind of fruit that Jesus is talking about. When the New Testament uses the term fruit, it uses it in a very specific sense. Look at Galatians 5:22, one of the most famous passages in the New Testament. It says, the fruit of the Spirit, the evidence of the authentic presence of the Spirit of Christ, the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, generosity, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Ladies and gentlemen, there you have it. It is the acid test, the biblical test that will never fail us. If you ever find yourself wondering about a spiritual leader or a church community, do a simple fruits analysis. Ask yourself questions like, examine a church community, whether it's this church community or some church community that you've participated in your past or that you may encounter in your future. If you have any questions, you stop and you ask yourself questions like these. How much love is there in this place? Is there peace here, or are people always at war? Is this a kind and generous community? Are the people and their leaders gentle or overbearing? Is there joy in this community, or a spirit of fear and anxiety? And notice, if you will, that this test that the Bible gives us for identifying false prophets is not, as I would have thought, a doctrinal test, but rather it is a character test. And that is very intentional, because knowing Jesus has always been a whole lot more about the heart than the head. I don't know about you, but I've known lots of people who could quote chapter and verse on most any subject you could raise about the Bible. I've known some people who could spout orthodox Christian doctrine with pen-like precision, and those things are great to be able to do. But I know some people who can do that and are still living lives that are filled with anger, harshness, judgment, impatience, hate, who go around with dour, downcast faces instead of exuding the joy of the Lord in their lives. I shared a story a couple months ago with those of us who read the daily Be Still devotional resource that's found on our church website. Let me share it again for those who didn't see it. Four pastors were standing around talking one day about their preferred translations of the Bible. One of them said, I prefer the King James Version for its beautiful poetic language. A second said, my favorite is the New Revised Standard Version for its scholarly precision. A third one said, my favorite is the New Living Translation because it's so easy to read, common, everyday language. The fourth was kind of silent until a friend said, hey, Jim, what's your favorite translation of the Bible? Actually, he said, it's my grandmother's translation. Wow. One of his friends said, I didn't know your grandmother was a Bible scholar. Oh, she wasn't, Jim said. But she translated the Bible every day into her daily life. And it was the most convincing translation I ever saw. That is precisely the point that Jesus is making in Matthew 7:16. You can fake right doctrine. Any old dummy with an unregenerated heart can memorize all the right answers to the doctrinal questions and spew them forth. You can fake right doctrine, but you cannot fake a right heart. Which is why Jesus says, if you want to know if somebody is real, do a fruits analysis. Ask yourself, am I seeing the fruit of the Spirit in that person's life? So, suppose somebody over the course of this Would Jesus Discriminate campaign comes to you and says, you know, I think your church is a bunch of false prophets. Kindly, gently, ask them if they're willing to apply the biblical test to that accusation. And then you start telling them about the fruit of the Spirit that you have witnessed and experienced in this place. You tell them about the joy of the Lord that we experience. Even tell them some of my bad jokes. That'll really get them. You tell them about how, although we are an imperfect church community, every church community is, you tell them how when somebody fails, we try to be gentle and patient. You tell them about the incredible generosity that you have seen in this congregation. You tell them about our homeless ministry, about our animal ministry, about the 35 impoverished children across the globe that this congregation supports. You tell them about the group of our people that are going to be at the Darfur rally at the State House today because we care when so many churches in Central Indiana could care less about people suffering in the middle of Africa. You tell them about how a whole group of people from our church are going to walk in the homeward bound walk next Sunday when most churches in Central Indiana could care less about people here who are starving and impoverished. Tell them about the generosity that you've seen in this place. Tell them about the joy. Tell them about the gentleness and the patience. Tell them that you have seen and experienced the Spirit of Christ in this place. And then say to them, if you really care about truth, come to church with me next Sunday and see for yourself so that you can make an informed decision. Years ago, when I was still deep in the closet and absolutely convinced that you can't be gay and Christian, I was having a running debate with a friend of mine. I was living in Washington, D.C. at the time. She was a straight woman, but we were having this running debate about this subject. And after we'd gotten through all of our doctrinal arguments, finally she said to me one day, Jeff, I dare you to go to the MCC that is here in Washington, D.C. sometime. And because I didn't want to seem close-minded, I said, okay, I will. I did. I came away from that worship service agitated and aggravated because it was confusing. Because what I saw there was contrary to the doctrine that I had been taught. I had to admit that worshiping in that place, I experienced the presence of the Spirit of Christ. And that was more powerful than all of the doctrinal arguments that I could raise against what was taking place in that place. It is a powerful argument, and when people are objecting, we need to bring them right back to this very simple, foundational, biblical point. Good trees bear only good fruit. Bad trees bear only bad fruit. If this church is bearing good fruit, then this church is a good tree. The prophets are good prophets, etc., etc. By the way, precisely this same point, this fruits analysis concept that Jesus articulates in Matthew 7:16, is also the definitive answer to the second of the arguments that Aunt Granny was raising in our conversation. Sometimes people will say those who are gay or transgender, they choose to be that way. We respond by saying, no, we've always experienced it as something that is innate to us, that we were born with. We even point to Matthew 19, 10 through 12, where Jesus acknowledges that certain people are born that way. To that, you'll recall Aunt Granny said, well, just because you're born that way doesn't make it right. And then she starts talking about pedophilia and addictions and other things that may have a genetic component. And you know what? If we're going to be honest, and we do need to be honest, because we are seekers of truth. If we're going to be honest, we have to say, you know, Aunt Granny, that's a pretty good point. Just because someone is born a certain way doesn't mean it's good to be that way. By the way, when we cite Matthew 19, 10 through 12, we're citing it not just because Jesus says some are born that way, but because he goes on to say that is a blessed way to be. But if all you're saying is, oh, I was born this way, it must be right. That's not a very good argument, because a pedophile or any number of other people could make that same claim. So how does a Christian decide what is right and wrong? How do we know which of our innate characteristics we should embrace and celebrate, and which of our innate characteristics we should resist and try to deal with? The answer is Matthew 7:16. You shall know them by their fruits. The very same test that can help us distinguish between true and false prophets also helps us distinguish between good and bad behavior. So if you ever find yourself in a complex moral situation, step back from that situation and ask the Matthew 7:16 question. Ask, does this activity bear good or bad fruit in the lives of the people it affects? Pedophilia destroys children. It's poisonous, bitter fruit. Don't do it. Addictions left untreated will ultimately destroy the addict's family, and do great damage to society at large, as when an addict drives under the influence. That is plain and obvious to anybody who looks at it. But now, apply this same question to same-sex relationships. My spouse, David, and I have been married now for 16 years. And I cannot begin to tell you how much better my life is because of his presence in it. I am a more spiritual person today than I would be without him. 10 years ago, when this church was calling me to be its pastor, and it was so tiny that it couldn't pay a living wage, when we were living over in Washington, D.C., my spouse could have said, we're not moving out there to Timbuktu for you to take a job that pays peanuts and blah, blah, blah. No, he said, if you feel called there, let's do it. Such incredible generosity. In our extended families, his or mine, if there is ever somebody in trouble, we are there. There is nothing that we wouldn't do for our extended families. They love us and we love them, and our extended families are stronger, not weaker, because of our presence as a spousal unit in that extended family. Is that good fruit or is that bad fruit? When my spouse David 12 years ago had a brain tumor, had to be surgically removed in 18 hours of surgery, he made me promise that I wouldn't leave the side of his bed, and I didn't. I slept on a old sleeping bag on that cold, hard hospital floor for about 6 days as he recovered, so that when he would wake up in the middle of the night with his head pounding and be disoriented, I could say, it's okay, everything's fine, you're going to be all right. Is that good fruit or is that bad fruit? A couple months ago, I got home from church really late one night. My spouse David was already in bed. I walk up to the table where I always eat my evening meal, and there was a little post-it note where he had written, Dear Jeff, I made some baked manicotti for you with whole wheat, fat-free noodles, ricotta cheese, mushrooms, diced tomatoes, asparagus. It's in the oven waiting for you. Love, David. I mean, do I have a great husband or what? And as I'm sitting there eating this gourmet meal, I'm thinking to myself, what did I ever do to deserve this? Of course, the answer is nothing, but wow. When two people love each other, that is a beautiful thing. You tell me, is that good fruit or is that bad fruit? And by the way, while we're on that subject of fruits analysis, That same point is also the reply to Aunt Granny's third key question. Remember the last question she asked? How can you be so sure that you're right? Sometimes when we talk about homosexuality in the Bible, it can get really complicated. We start talking about all these ancient Greek and Hebrew words. We start talking about what does malakoi and arsenikoitai mean in 1 Corinthians chapter 6. What does pais mean in Matthew chapter 8? What does debak mean in Genesis 2:24 and Ruth 1:14? And as you start to hear all of these Greek and Hebrew words swirling around and people arguing about ancient cultures and customs, you might find yourself stepping back from that and saying, how can I ever sort out all of these arguments? I'm not a Bible scholar. A couple years ago on the Jay Leno show, Jay was out, or the Tonight Show with Jay Leno, he was out doing this bit where he, you know, interviews people on the streets, and on this particular night the subject was, he was testing people's Bible knowledge, and so he stops these two college-age gals and he says to one of them, can you tell me one of the Ten Commandments? She thinks real hard for a second, and then she says, freedom of speech? He turns to the other and he says, can you complete this famous statement of Jesus? Let the one who is without sin, ... She thinks real hard. She says, let the one who is without sin learn to have a good time? That must be the new revised standard version. He stops this guy and says to him, who, according to the Bible, was swallowed by a whale? You could see it on his face. He was confident. He knew this answer. Pinocchio, he says. You may feel like one of those people. You may say, Jeff, I just don't know very much about the Bible. And so when people start arguing about it and throwing out these ancient words and these ancient customs, it gets really confusing to me. And how am I ever supposed to sort all of this out? Listen. It is good for us to learn everything that we can about some of these key passages and the Greek words and the history and the custom and the context that surround these passages so that we can have an intelligent conversation with somebody who wants to talk about chapter and verse. But in the final analysis, whether you are right or wrong as a gay or transgender person does not turn on ancient Greek words and culture and custom. Your spiritual foundation is much broader and deeper than that. The arguments that we make about Matthew chapter 8, Ruth 1:14, 1 Corinthians 6, listen to me, every one of those arguments could turn out to be flawed. I don't believe they are. I believe they're based on solid scholarship that will withstand the test of time, but assume hypothetically that somebody was able to knock each of those arguments down, you would still have a secure spiritual foundation. Because what is right or wrong in this world is not dependent upon ancient Greek words, culture, or custom. What is right or wrong in this world is based on something much more basic that anybody with a lick of common sense can understand. Do a simple fruits analysis. Jesus says bad things produce bad fruit, good things produce good fruit. Violence, abuse, pedophilia, addiction, those are destructive things, and it's obvious that they are producing bad fruit. Everybody gets that. But when two people come together to make a life commitment to each other, that benefits them, any children that are involved, whole extended families, and society in general, regardless whether that relationship is heterosexual or homosexual. Are there not some bad homosexual relationships in this world? Of course there are. There are as many abusive and dysfunctional homosexual relationships in this world as there are abusive and dysfunctional heterosexual relationships. If you find yourself in one of those relationships, either fix it or get out of it, because it will destroy you and the other people that are impacted by it. But for somebody to say that when two people pledge to love, support, nurture one another for richer or poorer, in sickness and in health, till death do us part. For somebody to say that that is bad is absolutely absurd. You don't have to have a PhD in biblical studies to understand that that is wrong. You, Aunt Granny sitting in her rocker, using her common sense, understands that if this relationship in your life is building you up and drawing you closer to God and making you a better person, then it's a good tree that is producing good fruit. So don't be so anxious. Relax. Your foundation is secure. Clever arguments will come and go. But Jesus' fruits analysis test is unassailable. It translates into every culture and time without a shadow of turning. It brings perfect clarity when a complex situation threatens to cloud our vision. So, if during the course of this Would Jesus Discriminate campaign, somebody gets in your face and says, I demand to know a reason for the hope that lies within you, you say to them, look, there is all kinds of biblical information, chapter and verse, that you can access on the wouldjesusdiscriminate.com website. Go there and read that. But what I want to tell you is my story. And then you tell them about how living in the closet almost destroyed you. Bad fruit. You tell them how the toxic, judgmental doctrines that you learned in the churches of your past almost killed you, body, soul, spirit. Bad fruit. You tell them how, since you've begun being more open and honest, your soul has begun to be set free, and you are drawing closer to God and beginning for the first time in your life to build an authentic, real, life-giving, uplifting relationship with Jesus Christ. Let them see the fruit of the Spirit in your life, because instinctively people understand Jesus' fruits analysis test, and if they see Christ in you, that more than anything else will challenge them to re-examine the false doctrines that they have learned about this subject. Let your light shine. If you are a straight person who is a part of this congregation, as many of you are, and somebody wants to get in your face about this church, you just tell them what you have seen here, the people you have encountered here, the fruit of the Spirit that you have seen at work in their lives. You tell them how this church is helping you to draw closer to God, how it's making a difference for you, how your relationship with God is much more authentic and real than it has ever been. Let your light shine. Because I tell you, sisters and brothers, in this world today, there is a great struggle for truth on this subject. Untruth is devastating millions of innocent people. And we have a moral responsibility to stand up and speak the truth. I close with this story. Earlier this week, I got to hear Vivian Stringer, the head coach of the Rutgers women's basketball team, whom Don Imus had slurred. She told a story about how when she was in high school, she tried out for cheerleader. She didn't make it. No African American had ever been selected for the cheerleading squad at her high school. She went home that day, disappointed, of course, but what are you going to do? This is the way things are. Later that evening, when her daddy got home from the coal mine, a teacher from the school showed up. When a teacher from the school shows up, you know something's going on. And so she says she secretly listened to this conversation between her daddy and the teacher. The teacher said, "Your daughter was not just one of the best, she was the best cheerleader who tried out. You need to appeal this to the school board." So when the teacher left, Vivian's daddy comes upstairs. Of course, she'd already heard all of this. And she says, "As I heard it, I felt excited because I thought I was pretty good, but I felt really nervous. Because, you know, what teenager wants to become the center of controversy? Teenagers just want to fit in, right?" So her daddy comes upstairs, repeats this conversation, and says, "Vivian, what do you want to do? Do you want to appeal?" "No," she says. Vivian, Her daddy said, "Now I want you to think about this, honey. If you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything. Honey, I want to tell you something. This is not just about you. This is about future generations. I want you to sleep on that and tell me your decision in the morning." She tossed and turned, thought and prayed all night. She gets up in the morning, goes downstairs, ready to give her answer. "Let's do it." So they appealed to the school board. The school board put her on the cheerleading squad. She went on to say, "I became such wonderful friends with those white girls, and they were changed. And Vivian was changed, because when you stand courageously like that, it changes your soul. It makes it better. That whole high school was changed." As Vivian said, "They have had many African American cheerleaders since I was there." None of us wants to stir up controversy. None of us wants to be in the center of controversy. But let me tell you something, sisters and brothers, this is not just about us. This is about future generations. May God give us the courage to stand tall, because courageous people change this world. Go out of this place today and let your light shine.